A student has left for me a question that he has written out. I'll come to that question in due course in a few days. We were making the point that from the biblical point of view, the realm of reality as seen by the man of faith is the realm of truth, and that to him the realm of mere appearance is the realm of ignorance and of falsehood, and the realm of moral nonsense or chaos. There are two realms. One is the realm of truth, and the other is the realm of ignorance and falsehood. The realm of truth is defined by man's relations to God and by God's judgment, as man understands it. The other is either a misreading of God's purposes or a neglect of God's purposes, God's judgment, but merely a view of life and the world with the naked eye of the body. Now, this idea of two realms at first blush may seem strange to us, but if you stop and think about it for a moment, you will realize that it's perhaps one of the most common phenomena in our own time and in human history. In our own time, for example, to take one or two instances very quickly, to a large portion of human society today living where Marxist ideology is regnant, a fundamental distinction is made between how the other part of the world views wars, economic depressions, social relations, political organization, and the way a Marxist views it. The Marxist does not see things from their point of view superficially, but he sees what others do not see. He sees the operation of laws from which there are no escape. For the man of truth, for the man of reality, the Marxist explanation is the true view, while any other explanation is, of course, a misleading, a misreading, and a misjudgment. To give you another example of a view that's common in our own time, Freudianism, which is very familiar to us today. We're all Freudians in one way or another. To a Freudian, human actions, and to those who apply Freudianism to anthropology and sociology and history and biography generally, the explanation is to be found not in what a person says he thinks or in what he says, but it's to be found in the unconscious and in the subconscious, in what he does not even know. He doesn't have the key to an understanding of reality. He moves in a realm of dreams, as it were, of shadows, of appearances, while underneath all that is conscious is the real key, the key to what is real and to what is the truth. So there are two realms immediately. The realm of appearance, as the Marxist sees it, and the realm of reality. And the Freudian, the realm of appearance, and and the realm of reality. And the two are quite different, one from the other. Now, this fundamental difference between two realms is probably inescapably human. I think one can find it in all. I haven't investigated all societies. I don't know that anybody else has. But an awful lot of facts on all levels of anthropology and history would point to this as a fundamental human characteristic. And much of what we in our Western culture assume as a matter of fact and operate with almost unconsciously goes back to the Greeks, who made this as a fundamental distinction. They applied the distinction to physics, as we would call it today, to the physical aspects of life, to what we would call today philosophical truth, metaphysical truth, which in time became the basis for science. Let me very briefly review this development. It will occupy us only a few minutes, but it will be very useful to us at this point and in future discussions in the course. The philosopher known as Thales, had the names written on the board so that I don't have to take the time to do this for you. Thales, who one of the great pre-Socratic, pre-Platonic philosophers, who lived in the 6th century, said that no matter how the world may appear to common sense and to the senses, the fundamental element of the world is water. Everything is made up of water, and everything could be reduced to water. Empedocles, in the 5th century, a century after Thales, said that the world was made up of four elements, not just one. Water was one, but he added air, fire, and earth. So that no matter how complicated anything might appear to be, that object, it could be the sun, the moon, the earth itself, a mountain, anything could be reduced to these four basic elements. The philosopher by the name of Anaxagoras, also in the 5th century, said that things only appear to be solid, a chair, a piece of wood, a piece of metal. But in fact, everything is made up of what he called seeds or particles. And each particle has its own unique qualities. But an article consists of particles, the preponderance of which are similar. And so we call a thing a stone, we call a thing wood or copper or whatever it may be. But in fact, that piece of stone is made up of a great many seeds or particles that are quite different one from the other. But there are enough among them to be similar so that the thing comes to have the appearance of uniformity. Democritus, also in the 5th century, said that reality was made up of atoms. Here we get, of course, the atomic notion, which has played such a role in science. The atoms are indivisible. They are the ultimate units of which reality is made. And the atoms are in constant motion. The eye doesn't see them. Appearances are very different from the reality. Now, in this way, the Greeks arrived over the centuries at a broad conception, which has played a tremendous role in society and life and thought, in our work. The fundamental distinction between the senses and what the senses give us, and thought, or nous in Greek, what thought gives us. The truth can be arrived at only by thought. The senses only mislead. They give us appearances. The senses tell us, to take an example very familiar to all of us, that the sun rises and the sun sets. But we know differently. We know it not from our senses, we know it from our thought. Now, you can readily see how basic to scientific development these philosophic projections of the difference between appearance and reality have been. Heraclitus, who bridged the 6th and the 5th centuries, one of the great names in ancient philosophy, held that there is nothing permanent. There is only becoming. There is only motion. Everything is in motion. The eye deceives by seeming to suggest that things are stable, fixed. But he said, that isn't so. All is flux. Nothing is stationary. He said that it is not possible to step into the same river twice. The river is not the same, and he who steps in it is not the same. On the other hand, Parmenides, in the 5th century, held just the opposite, that motion is only appearance. The change is only an illusion of the senses. There is only being. There is no becoming, no matter what the senses may say. Well, the substance of what these philosophers offered us aren't as important as the underlying propulsion and the end result, which are the distinction between what the senses report to us and what the mind arrives at independently of the senses. Plato in the 4th century pushed these distinctions about as far as anyone could or would in ancient philosophy. To him, the distinction became the difference between the world of nature, the world of sense data, on the one hand, and on the other, the realm of pure ideas, or the form, which in a sense are supernatural. And there are the realms of nature and the realm of supernature. We, for example, talk about beautiful things. We talk about the just and the unjust actions of men. We talk about this being good, that being not good, bad, evil. But Plato argued that we have these notions, but we couldn't have them if there weren't the pure idea of beauty, and the pure idea of justice, and the pure idea of the good, of which whatever we see and judge to be beautiful or just or good are only rough approximations. We never find in life perfect justice. We never find perfect beauty. We never find the perfect good. As much as we want peace, for example, in Indochina, the peace is not a perfect good. We know how rough it is, how only remotely approximate it is to any idea of the perfect good. So there must be these perfections, these ideas that are pure, of which we see only, as it were, shadows, mere approximations in life. The perfect ideas do not exist in this world. No matter where you go, you will not find them. They must, therefore, have their existence in a realm that is supernatural, in another world. There is therefore this world, and there is another world. In the other world, there are no bodies, there are no physical senses. There are only the pure ideas. Mathematical theorems, particularly geometry, played a tremendously important role in Greek thought. And Plato was concerned about the validation and the origin of mathematical theorems, geometrical forms, geometrical relations. How do we know about them? For example, you try to discover the relationship between one side of a triangle and the other sides of a triangle. And there are relations. Euclid discovered what they were, formulated them in great precision. You draw a triangle on the board, but it's not a perfect triangle. And no matter how many you will draw, they will not be perfect triangles. You draw a circle, it's only an approximation to a circle. The mathematical relations are exact, they're precise. But they don't apply to what we draw on a board. They apply to the perfect circle, to the perfect circumference, to the perfect hypotenuse, to the perfect rectangle. Plato at one time, we don't know, he may have lived with the idea all his life, but he formulated at one time the theory of, in the dialogue, the Meno, the theory of recollection of ideas. He made an experiment in this dialogue with a boy who was ignorant, he hadn't gone to school, he didn't study Euclid, and yet Socrates, in the dialogue, by taking this young man through steps of thought, moving slowly so that the person would understand the questions, but nonetheless moving step by step, this person was able to see rather complex mathematical relationships, geometrical theorems. And Socrates asked in this Platonic dialogue, how come How could this be possible? And his answer, Plato's answer, was that the soul of this young man had been, prior to his existence, exposed to the pure forms. And among the pure forms were the mathematical theorems and the geometrical forms. He had seen a perfect circle, as it were. He had seen, his soul had seen the perfect triangle, the perfect rectangle. And now in this life, when the proper occasion presents itself, he acts as if he recalled what he had learned in another life, in prior existence. This is the theory of knowledge as recollection. And Plato applied this to morality, to the concept of justice, to the concept of the good. The most unsophisticated person has responses to situations which he judges to be just or unjust, to be good or evil, or in aesthetics, to beauty and its opposite. And so Socrates or Plato argued that these responses are in effect based on recollections of the perfect ideas. In the most famous of all Plato's dialogues, we're not going into Plato, but I'm simply trying to establish a certain proposition here, and a certain way of thought, which is so fundamental to us. In the Republic, there is the famous myth of the cave. Briefly, Plato draws a picture through Socrates, who's the character in the dialogue, and it may be a Socratic dialogue for all we know. Men sit in a dark cave with their backs to the opening. The opening to the cave is in back of them. They don't see it. Light comes in from the opening, and as events happen outside of the cave, those events throw their shadows on the wall. It's as if I were sitting, this was all that I knew of the world, just faced the board and, as it were, a screen, and what was happening in back of me would be projected on the screen. These are shadows. And men sit in the cave and watch the shadows, but they accept them as their realities. This is all they seem to know, all they seem to be aware of. But the wise man, who knows of what is happening, he knows that these are mere shadows. Well, you can see how this kind of a myth has its applications in all sorts of philosophical, religious, ideological contexts. A Marxist, in effect, uses the myth of the cave. We see wars, we see crimes, we see ignorance, illiteracy, we see injustice, but we see only shadows. We interpret them as if these were real in the sense that we understand what is happening in front of us. But the Marxist has seen the light. He knows that there is something else that is operative, which only throws and projects these events on the screen or on the board or on the wall. So he can distinguish between the reality, as you see, and the shadow. We, of course, have our own interpretation. We make this similar distinction, but from a different point of view, but it doesn't matter. The important thing here is that the Greeks, as well as the Hebrews, and as far as I know, other people as well, assume the existence of two worlds. There isn't one world, there are two worlds. I saw recently some pictures of Australian contemporary. These are people who are now living. And, they've been Australian Aborigines, very primitive people. They live practically in the Stone Age. But at various times, they decorate their bodies and they go through very complex motions of dances with music, some chants, during which time they seem to be living in another world. These are, of course, mystical, mythical, religious events. They seem to be transported into another realm altogether, a realm of magic, ghosts, another world altogether for them. And I think that this would be true of any society of men. Now, in the Bible, the difference is that in the Bible, there's the world as God sees it, and the world as ordinary men without faith as they see it. What has happened in terms of the development of our culture is that the Greeks, being primarily concerned with metaphysics, with philosophy, have given us the basis for science. Well, the Hebrews, the biblical man, was concerned with the two worlds in terms, the two realms, in terms of the religious and the moral applications. But each made a similar distinction, division. At a later point in time, and we will have a chance, I hope, to discuss some of this later. At a later point in time, the two worlds became this world and the next world, which is a familiar notion to us. It became the world of matter and the world of spirit. It became the world of the body and the world of the soul. Two different realms, two different beings. It became the world of time on the one hand and the world of eternity, timelessness, on the other. But despite these later developments, the original Hebraic sense of the world, as on the one hand the ignorant man sees it, and on the other hand as the man of faith sees it, persisted. That distinction has never been lost sight of. Just as in the case of the Greeks, with the same kind of developments, as we will show you, the original distinction between the world of the senses and the world of thought continued becoming philosophy and becoming eventually science. The biblical man certainly approximated and sometimes expressly, as we will find in the literature, Plato's myth of the cave. The wise man knows, and we'll see how this applies in specific books of the Bible, the wise man knows that God is light, just as in the Platonic myth of the cave, the truth was the sun. So the wise man knows that God is the light. Reality is only that upon which the light falls. That is the men and the events, only as they are seen by God. While ignorant men see only shadows or appearances, which they call real. St. Paul, in the first book of Corinthians, says, "For our knowledge is imperfect. For now we see in a mirror dimly," it's almost the identical figure of speech, "but then face to face. See in a mirror dimly," it's almost the identical figure of speech, "but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall understand fully." Now the now and the then are very ambiguous, and purposely so, and they play different roles. In the context, it seems to mean that now I see imperfectly, but I will see with the eyes of love. That's what the context seems to convey as its meaning. And then I will see fully. I will understand everything. My love is now only approximate. It's only an image, a shadow of the kind of love which I should have. So that then, meaning under other circumstances, in another context, it needn't mean in the other world, in the world to come. It can mean that, but it's ambiguous enough to mean several things simultaneously. With the eyes of love, or with the eyes of God, or in Christian terms, with the eyes of Christ, things take on a totally different meaning. Then one sees reality. In the Hellenistic period, which we'll discuss in due course, Plato and Platonism and Stoicism served as a bridge between the Greeks and the Hebrews, Hebrew thought, Hebraic thought, and Christian thought. And in turn, Judaism and Christianity influenced Greek thought, so that the result was a syncretic or a kind of an amalgamation of different influences. But this is not the time to get into it. I'm simply laying the groundwork for a later discussion. Now, notwithstanding this influence, the difference between the Hebraic and the Greek has, as I said before, remained a fundamental one. For example, the story of creation in Genesis. There's no concern, if you read it carefully, and if you read it after coming to the Bible with knowledge of what the Greeks have done, as I've just, for example, very quickly and most inadequately summarized for you. There's absolutely no concern with the kinds of questions which these Greek philosophers would have asked about creation, the origin of the world. They would have asked, out of what was the world created? Air, fire, water, whatever it may be. Do appearances, do the senses give us a true reflection of reality, or do they not? What is the nature of the sun, of the moon, of the stars, of the earth? What is light? These are the kinds of questions that they would have asked. What is life? On one of the days of creation, life was created. Living animals, fish, birds, ultimately man. The biblical story, altogether different. There, the central interest is on who made the world, and especially who made man, and what did the maker of the world and of man think of his creation? Because the Creator's judgment is somehow reflected in his handiwork. So the Bible states at the end of each day of creation what God said of his work. And God saw it was good. This is the way Genesis reports it. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, there was morning, one day. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And again, the refrain, and God saw that it was good. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And again, and God saw it that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a third day. At the end of the sixth day, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. There was evening and there was morning, a sixth day. Now, this is not the judgment of Adam and Eve. It doesn't purport to be the judgment of Adam and Eve, that the creation of the first day was good, the creation of the second day was good, the creation of the sixth day was very good. It's the only place where the Bible says it was very good, only after man was created. It's only God's judgment that's important here. How does God view creation? What does he have to say about it? Because the biblical mind was interested only in the moral reality, not in the physical reality. The moral reality of the world and of man. This is fundamental. And it marks an inescapable, sharp differentiation between the Bible and other sources of our culture. Are there any questions up to this point? Yes, sir. Yes. It's creation in the Bible, and this has always been the case in Judaism, and it always represented one aspect of Christianity, but often in the past had been overlaid with other considerations, but now has been in more recent times been rediscovered and has received a great deal of emphasis. That creation itself is good, as the world is not evil, that the physical aspect of the world is not necessarily evil, that it is good, that the sharp differentiation between matter and spirit, or between body and soul, as it came to be translated, is not a biblical conception, but actually goes back to the Greeks, to Plato and Neoplatonism, Plotinus, and other sources of influence. But that the original biblical conception is of the goodness of creation, and that man is the end for which the first 5 days of creation took place. And then when all of creation was viewed by God in all the complex interrelations, with man at the center, with man having dominion, even then God said not only that it was good, but that it was very good. Now, I want to say something. I see some of you smiling and quizzically, skeptically. I don't blame you. Some of this may sound new to you, and when it hits you for the first time, you have problems. But I'm trying to convey to you not something that I'm asking you to believe. That's your business and not mine. I'm asking you to understand, to know and to understand. What you do with the knowledge and the understanding isn't something that I can become concerned with. But before you smile skeptically and cynically, I ask you to suspend your disbelief and try to see the picture as it has been seen for thousands of years by countless millions of human beings. And in one way or another, even the skeptics and the cynics are still products of our culture. And this is part of our culture. And even those who reject it still make use of it, because the fundamental difference between the moral realm and the physical realm, and our primary concern, especially today, with the moral over the physical, is something that we do need to understand. Somebody else had a hand up here. Yes? Yes. Well, I can't get into a theological conception like original sin at this point. But what we have in Genesis is not a description, but a moral judgment of what is potentially possible. As man is good, God did not create him a devil. He created him man. But then you have the problem of man's freedom and what that can do. Man would not be as good as he is, that is from the standpoint of being very good, if man did not have freedom. Then man would be like the lion and the lamb and the cow and other animals. There'd be no differentiation. He wouldn't be man if he could not commit evil. He could not commit evil if he were not free. If he's free, it can only mean that he can commit evil. Cain can kill Abel. But what was that? Well, look, as I told you, I'm not going to get into theological, dogmatic problems. Even Christians do not agree on the meaning of original sin or in a belief in original sin. I'm concerned with the biblical view as we have it and not with the Nicene Creed or other interpretations of it. Well, we'll continue this when we come back on